On the last episode of the Video Archives podcast, Quentin and Roger gave us an honest, in-depth analysis of Bob Fosse's Star 80.
What's gobsmacking is the fucking balls of Fosse to tell the story, a true story of a murdered woman that only happened 2 years earlier from the killer's point of view.
We talked about personal stories, the real history, and how some things just didn't sit right. But the conversation didn't stop there. Today on The After Show, we continue the discussion, bringing you more opinions and facts from Roger and Quentin. I'm your girl, Gala Avery. To start off our episode today, we have part two of my interview with Roger. Missed part one? Make sure to go back to After Show episode 6 so you don't miss a thing. Now, do you remember the first time that you met Quentin at Video Outtakes?
Yes. I mean, I remember him coming in. And at that time, I remember in particular him going, like, just talking about They All Laughed, the Bogdanovich film with Dorothy Stratton. And I think he and Lance, I think, would talk about it a lot. And I hadn't seen the film at that point. And so
– that movie's kind of hard to find, actually, nowadays. I tried to find that after our discussion on Dorothy Stratton and Star 80. Because that's kind of like the movie that they were making at that time. And it's really difficult to find.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Like, you'd think that in this day and age, everything is easy to get instantly. And yet it's not. What's that all about?
Beats me.
Seems like it's almost harder to get.
That's what eBay's for.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in the old days, you just walk down to the video store and look at the shelves. So I almost want to say superficially knew Quentin. Almost in a kind of jealous way, I knew Quentin to begin with. He's the Lance's other lover who's coming talking cinema.
It's like in Pokemon when all of a sudden you meet Gary Oak.
Yeah.
It's like,
I don't even know what you're saying, but yes.
Professor Oak's nephew, and all of a sudden you're not the star child anymore. You gotta like battle it out.
Well, there it is.
Two titans together. So.
Well, and then, you know, Quentin comes in and you talk with him for 5 minutes, then these are not 1 minute, and you know right away, one, he knows what he's talking about, two, he asserts it. And so if you're going to enter into a conversation with him about movies, you're going to have to back it up. You're going to have to back it up. And so I only knew him like kind of
tangentially.
Yeah, I would say almost tangentially, like, and maybe even a little jealously. Because he was, coming in, but not really. He's just another customer. I will say, and I don't want to say this, like, I don't want to say anything negative, and I don't even think of it as negative, but Quentin used to wear this leather jacket, this gnarly leather jacket, and I think he would just sweat into it. And
it smelled
like leather, like patent leather, like this intense. And so he would come in, and I think that was probably because I was jealous. My big, oh, that guy who smells or what, something like that. Anyhow, cut to, we open up Video Archives.
Yet actually, before you go into like hiring Quentin, because I know that's where the kind of the story is leading, what led to Video Outtakes becoming Video Archives?
I think it was just a natural growing process, and I don't know the particulars of what was going on or if anything was going on between the two partners, Dean and Lance.
You just know that you were called upon by Lance.
Suffice it to say, I was it becomes so personal, it's almost not right to talk about, but the fact of the matter is – Scott's father was in a little bit of a bitter divorce, and his whole family was kind of in turmoil. I had come from a divorced family. I sided with Scott and his mother, and sided. I mean, I wasn't even in a place to side, but I was an employee there, and it became very uncomfortable very quickly.
Well, I think
many ways.
A good question also is that you've mentioned that when Lance opened up Video Archives, didn't Scott go with you?
Yes. Well, Scott kind of also played the fence a little bit.
So he went,
like, initially he went with us, and then, you know, he would go back and work at Video. Yeah. I mean, he's it's his dad.
Yeah, like, of course.
And so, you know, Scott eventually went back.
Yeah. So Lance takes his half or his third or however many of the
tapes. However many tapes he took. He took what was his.
He took what was his and he went and he opened up.
He did some kind of a formal separation. And I think in one night, everything happened.
You guys took the videotapes that were Lance's.
And a new store opened up. In a different city the next day.
In Hermosa Beach?
In Manhattan Beach.
In Manhattan Beach.
It
okay.
It was located at 1822 North Sepulveda.
And I think
there's a
pet food store there now or a bagel shop.
Actually the shop moved. And so it used to be at the corner location.
Yeah.
And then it moved to the inside location, or maybe it was the other way around. No, it was the inside location.
Well, it's in that little shopping center regardless.
Yeah, I think the last position that it was at the bagel shop.
Okay. Now tell me.
Which is now a Noah's Bagel.
Is it? Okay.
I think it's Noah's Bagels.
Okay. Now tell me, so.
Or maybe it's a Manhattan Beach Bagel Company, actually. Yeah, I better get that right. Fact check that. Yeah. All the fact checkers.
Ring, ring, ring. Okay, so you had known Quentin from video outtakes.
Yeah.
You guys open up video archives. How did he get hired?
Scott was like with us in those early days and Lance, and there was an absolute need for new employees. And I don't doubt for a second that it was just Lance who immediately said, what about that guy? And Quentin came in, and I can't even remember if it was an interview. I thought it was an interview because he came in, he went behind the counter, sat in the back office and talked and everything. And next thing I knew, he was hired. And then there were two other partners. Lance had taken on two other partners. One of them was a silent partner who we wouldn't even know existed for years to mm-hmm. come. The other one was this guy, Rick, who was there all the time.
Is that silent partner Dennis?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
It was the two brothers, Rick and Dennis Humbert. And Rick was sort of the, he was kind of like a groovy, cool, South Bay music guy. And had lots of connections everywhere and was actually really good for the store. Brought in lots, you know, he was a really good guy to work with. But I remember early on, he was like, Roger, get over here. And I came over, I'm like, yeah. And he's like, do you know this Quentin guy? And I'm like, I'm like, yeah. He's like, what do you think? And I said, well, you know, he's got this leather jacket. I think I brought that up. He said, well, look at this. And he showed me a check that Quentin had filled out. Like they had to buy tapes, you know, every now and then UPS would come or Black Hawk Video or like, you know, the video we'd have
to delivering
have,
the new tapes.
We would actually have to make a payment. And I guess he had made a payment and paid for it. He'd been told, okay, just fill out the check when they come. And he filled it out. And I don't know if you've ever seen Quentin's penmanship, but he's famous for his penmanship. And this was an early version of his penmanship, which was more emotion than actual logic. It's more art than science. Let's just say that. And he showed it to me and it was like, you know, there wasn't enough space to write out what he had written. So it kind of curved down it was actually really funny. It was great. And he was like all like freaking out about it, like that this was this big deal. Okay. So anyhow, cut to Quentin ends up starting like to do shifts with me and we start working together. And my first instinct was, you know, I'll show you. But then you start working with them and you learn like one, he knows what he's talking about and he can back it up. Respect. Like you're like, it just is what it is. And pretty soon it was like, okay, this guy is special. This guy's different than normal human beings. Like
he's got a superpower.
Yeah. This is a guy who was born like, you know, in a gamma radiation chamber. He has a superpower that actually I've only met one other person who.
Okay. I know who you're going to say. Yeah. Before you said, I'm just going to say, I don't think he rivals Quentin. In that way.
He aspires to rival Quentin.
Because he told me he had seen every movie. And the moment that I brought up Brotherhood of Death, he hadn't seen it.
Yeah, boy, he like tail went between his legs.
Yeah.
We're talking about Christophe Gans.
Sorry, Christophe.
The French director of Silent Hill and Brotherhood of the Wolf.
I hope Christophe has seen Brotherhood of Death by now.
Oh, I'm sure he went home and he was freaking out. Because that, I don't think, happens to him normally.
Yeah.
That. But, you know, Christoph is the same way, that he, like, he loves media. He consumes it. It is his life. It is his, you know, it's the fabric of who he is. Mm-hmm. He can back up, you know, his conversations with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and thousands of hours of, you know, investment in cinema.
And also not only have seen the movie, but be able to make a whole discussion, opinion about it. Because there's one thing, that there are people that just sit down and watch five movies a day, every day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And have nothing to say about them and don't know how to read a film.
Well, and that was the great thing about having a brick and mortar place for us to hang out in, the store to work in, because we would pop on movies. And this is kind of how our relationship evolved, is that we were working together and we would put on movies. And I would put on the movies that I liked, and he would put on the movies that he liked. And we have different tastes, but they're, you know, like a Venn diagram. They
overlap at some area.
They overlap. And pretty soon it was like, I mean, I don't know how else to put it other than we were doing what we're basically doing now, which is watching movies and talking about them and laughing and having fun. And next thing I knew, it was like, okay, it does not have to be a rival just because he is invincible and powerful.
You guys can be allies.
You can be allies. And anyhow, like, you know, and it wasn't even just Quentin. Like, there were a bunch of guys that kind of gravitated into that store. Roland Wofford, Steve Opoli. I mean, they're Unruly Julie. There were all sorts of people who, you know.
A whole crew. It's a clan.
Yeah, like of like-minded people, all of whom had their, you know, special
genre.
Yeah, their genre superpower. Like Steve-O was, you know, loved a certain kind of thing, like the Apple Dumpling Gang movies and shit like that. He could talk about those endlessly and knew every little detail about them.
Man, I bet that the person that came in looking for the Apple Dumpling Gang was really happy when Steve-O was working.
Yeah, Steve-O or Russell Vossler. I mean, he's another name who probably will come up again and again and again and again, because Russell is one of the titans of that place. He, mm-hmm. You know, he's one of the great characters. He's one of the best people to work with at that store. He's a really gentle soul. You know, he's a really good person, and he's super talented. That's the other thing, is he's an artist. Like a lot of the people that would come in, they were these super talented artists. And so they would be doing the painting of the, you know, the store art on the, like every holiday season.
Yeah. I love that. I love those photos that I've seen of those. Yeah.
Which I'll send Josh's way at some point. And so like, yeah, you'd get all these people to come together. And Russell also happened to know the Disney movies like really well. Like he, you know, was completely dialed into the children's film section. So whenever a mother would come in with her kids, you know, Russell would be a great one to advise them and guide them into watching the
movie. Man,
right,
I wish I had Russell, you guys.
Russell was the algorithm for the mothers that came in.
I wish I had your team like helping me find movies, because I mean, I guess that's what the podcast is you guys helping all of us out here find new movies that are difficult to find.
Or even old ones that you may have seen that you forgot. Like one of the movies, we probably won't talk about it because we watched it kind of before we began this, but like, you know, Quentin and I watched Maria's Lovers, the Andrei Konchalovsky film. I hadn't seen it since, you know, the movie had come out, and it's with Nastassja Kinski, who I was in love with when I was young. And it's a really interesting, kind of compelling, dynamic little movie. People might have seen it before, and, you know, even me, like I saw the movie before, and in reassessing it, it's like, wow, this is a really interesting little film.
I love hearing video archive stories from my dad. Believe me, there are tons. So stay tuned for the next part of the interview. Now, let's return to our topic of the episode, Star 80. Anyone who knows me will know that I am a Patty Chayefsky fan. Seeing Altered States and reading the book changed my life. So, if you're like me, you'll take delight in this next story from Quentin.
What's interesting, especially with Fosse deciding to write this script himself and being somewhat influenced by his buddy, Patty Chayefsky,
sure,
who he would show him a few different drafts. And
he dedicated the movie to him.
Yes, he dedicates the movie to him. And then there's also even the idea that Fosse did not make it a point to write his scripts. So he wanted to do the first draft on this, and then he wanted to bring in another writer to take it, make it better. But he showed it to Chayefsky and goes, no, you don't need anybody else. No, you finish this on your own. This is you're on the right track.
Well, that's the having Paddy Chayefsky tell you you're on the right track would only throw gas onto that fire.
Yeah, absolutely.
One of my favorite parts of the episodes are when Quentin and Roger talk about the first time they watched the movie. Roger lets us know where he first saw Star 80 and who he saw it with.
Did you see it in Westwood?
Yeah.
National.
Yes, I did. At the lovely National. Mm-hmm. And I think I saw
all the Warner Brothers movies.
And I think I saw it with Scott, actually. Uh-huh. I think we saw it together.
That was a Warner Brothers theater. All the Warner Brothers big releases played at the National.
And Scott was really big on this movie also.
Me and Scott shared a real healthy appreciation of Eric Roberts in particular. We both really, really liked him.
Yeah.
Not the first time, but I think there was another screening of one of my three screenings of the movie. One was with my old friend Kevin, but the other one was with Scott, I think, because we wanted to watch the Eric Roberts movie together.
I think he saw it many, many times.
Yeah, yeah.
Star 80.
When I'm not watching movies, I love to sit down and watch trashy reality TV, Star Trek, and true crime. I had a little bit of prior knowledge about Paul Snyder and his connection with Chippendales from watching Curse of the Chippendales on Discovery Plus. I brought this knowledge to the table when discussing Star 80.
I'm glad you brought that up, Quentin, because one of the things I know about Dorothy Stratton is because my mom and I, we watch a lot of true crime together. Mm-hmm. And she and I think actually, Roger, I think you watched this with us. We watched Curse the Chippendales on Discovery Plus, which is a miniseries about Chippendales. I mean, Chippendales has its own true crime history with like two murders involved of the owner and one of the dancers, I think.
Yeah, all those criminals involved in Chippendales were basically the ones probably holding him over the balcony.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but like, they have a whole interesting thing.
They all turned on each other.
On Dorothy Stratton and Paul Snyder in the first few episodes of that, because as we've touched on, Paul Snyder basically introduced the idea of wet t-shirt contests and Chippendales to America from Canada. And one of the big defining moments that they talk about Paul Snyder and Dorothy Stratton and what leads to her murder is that Playboy Playmate of the Year awards ceremony.
Oh, uh-huh.
They talk about how he went and how he thought that Dorothy should be thanking him while she's giving her award. And also how when she takes the photograph, they actually push him off stage.
Yeah, yeah.
Like they escort him to a different table and they say, no, you sit over here.
Well, it's like usually you thank your manager. That's not unusual.
I was surprised in Star 80 how they did not dramatize that scene. Because I felt like that was actually a scene where it was kind of an important character moment for Paul Snyder, and they kind of just left it out.
Yeah, and it would have served Fosse's agenda.
I think it's possible that he never saw that footage. I mean,
that is definitely possible because
they didn't put that together until almost 10 years after Dorothy's life.
Yeah,
so,
of course.
So I don't. So he, they might have not turned over all that.
Yeah,
footage.
He might have not known that. And of course, the movie doesn't represent everything in their real life because it's a movie. Mm-hmm. Movies can't be real life or else it would be a documentary.
No, but I'm glad you brought that up because that observation about her during that footage is, it's almost paramount to my opinion.
Yeah.
About how they portrayed Dorothy.
Yeah. Because we have all of this information now that maybe they didn't know back then and people wouldn't have known. That brings me to my next point though. I don't know what's real in this movie and what's fake in this movie. I don't know exactly everything about Paul Snyder they say in this movie. I don't know if it's real. I know he made exercise machines. I don't know if he made sex machines. I know he did wet t-shirt contest, but I don't know if he did this. And I know he was with Dorothy Stratton. I don't know if he was cheating on Dorothy Stratton.
Most of the biographical stuff, as far as from everything I know about the story, and I kind of probably know a little bit more than most, seems all fairly true.
Yeah.
And is it a wet t-shirt contest? Is it a jello wrestling contest? Who fucking cares? All right.
Exactly,
but it's all the same. Believe.
Yeah. And that's why it's so good, because honestly, after I had watched the Chippendales documentary and then I watched this movie and I was kind of interested in learning more about it. And it's very vague online what you can find out about the true story.
Eric Roberts' portrayal of Paul Snyder may take center stage, but we here at Video Archive spent a lot of time analyzing how Fosse portrayed Dorothy Stratton. Roger had some issues with the film, specifically the characterization of Stratton.
I'm going to say that, yes, the Dorothy Stratton character is a caricature, but maybe that was to protect her in some ways from the story that he's telling. Because if he had made her as savvy as she really was, as we know she must have been from those interviews and the way that she's responding, if it was that person, she might have been a little bit more culpable even. As it is, she is such a leaf in the wind, and he is portrayed as right and sympathetic up until the point where he buys the shotgun. Everything he's doing is somewhat justified, because I do not believe in violence of any kind. When the movie is lying, it's when it's aping reality. It's when they're doing interviews of her. It's when they're imitating photos of her and photo shoots of her. Like, to me, that's when the movie lies. It attempts to trick us into believing that these people that we're seeing are real.
Well,
this mime that we're watching, oh, this is reality. And frankly, I think you're probably right. When they say partly real, that's the part that is real. And to me, that's the most false presentation.
There are many real-life people depicted in Star 80. You have the obvious Dorothy Stratton, Paul Snyder, and Hugh Hefner. However, there's one real-life person who is not depicted by name. Film geeks like us know that the director character, played by Roger Rees, is representative of Peter Bogdanovich. Quentin clues us in on why Bogdanovich is not named in this film.
I think it's interesting to contemplate the idea that if you were to tell the Dorothy Stratton story, what would that be? To remove the shark from the hook just a little bit when it comes to Fosse, he was not allowed to tell the story the way it needed to be. Not that he had any interest in doing this. He did not. But if he had an interest in telling the story from Dorothy Stratton's perspective, he wouldn't have been able to, because he can't deal forthrightly with Hefner and he can't deal forthrightly with Peter Bogdanovich. Now, the thing about it is he needs Hefner's consent to do things that he needs to do. He wants to be able to call him Hugh Hefner. He wants to be able to have a bit of an impersonation
of Playboy Mansion. And he wants all of the
They didn't shoot it at the Playboy Mansion. But
it looks enough like what the Playboy Mansion in my mind would look like.
It looks exactly like the Playboy Mansion. And Hefner did allow his production designer to come in and take photos and to, you know, copy the Playboy Mansion. But he also wants to be able to use Playboy. I mean, in fact, if he can't use the name Playboy and he can't use the logo of Playboy,
he doesn't want to make the movie.
And he can't use the bunny costumes and everything, then he doesn't want to even, then he's not interested in doing the movie at all.
Which I completely agree with.
However, if he had gone another route and if he had did Phantoms, which it, well, a lot of movies do that. All right. So if it was not, we all know
Play Mag.
Well, Stag Magazine. Yes. All right. It's Stag Magazine. And the guy's name is Lou Hopper. Yes. All right. You know, he would be able to do what he wants to do, but he wants to be able to name names. But he's not, you know, he's not allowed to. Bogdanovich at that time is not going to let him use his likeness. Hefner is going to want some control over their use of Hefner's likeness and the Playboy ideal. So there is an aspect that the Dorothy Stratton story was just too fresh. Now you can use Peter Bogdanovich if you were telling the story. You could use Hugh Hefner and Playboy magazine imagery if you wanted, because now you could actually kind of tell the story. But if you did tell the story of Dorothy Stratton, her story is damn close to almost a Henry James novel of this beautiful young girl, pretty much like a country lass, and how she's taken to the big city and finds herself with three different mentor men who fold her under their wing. It's easy to say, and Mariel Hemingway's even said it in an interview, well, these men came and molded her. Okay, well, wait a minute now. In the case of Peter Bogdanovich and Dorothy Stratton, they were in love with each other. And to tell the story from Dorothy Stratton's perspective and not have it be Peter Bogdanovich, who Peter Bogdanovich is to make it a farce.
As Quentin just said, Dorothy Stratton and Peter Bogdanovich were in love. Quentin goes a little further and talks about the knowledge that a director can impart on a small town girl, specifically teaching her the difference between movies and films.
I'm sure Dorothy Stratton likes movies as much as any young girl
and any other Playboy playmate.
And any young girl in Vancouver likes movies. I doubt she's a cinephile. She probably went and saw a couple of films and probably has a couple of actors or actresses that she likes. But now with Peter Bogdanovich, I see him like he would do with all of his girlfriends, giving her a complete introduction to classic cinema and teaching her the difference between Mitchell Leeson and Lubitsch. And I see them, you know, like Mariel Hemingway was doing with Woody Allen in Manhattan, laying in bed watching W.C. Fields, or laying in bed and watching Marlene Dietrich, and Bogdanovich telling her the whole history and how he knew this director and that director, and her being completely charmed and whisked away. You can't tell the story without having that part of the love story.
Exactly. And I mean, I think he tries to touch on it briefly, because Eric Roberts even has a line in it where he says, she called him films.
That's one of the best lines in the whole goddamn movie.
Yeah, she's never called films. No, she'll call them movies. No.
That's what he knows.
That's actually been one of the lines that has stayed in my head since I saw it 30 years ago, or 40 years ago, or whatever, however many fucking years ago it was, 83. All right, that's always the state of my mind. And like, oh, no, he's right.
No,
that's
but
smart.
He's always right. Throughout the entire movie, he may not be justifiable in what he does, but he is always correct throughout the film. His assessments are correct. That he's being fucked over is correct.
His
suggestions to her are correct. His advices in management is correct. Everything is correct. He's true to himself. And
he presents Dorothy as a Fosse, presents Dorothy as a dummy. He does not present Snyder as a dummy.
No, he does not.
He presents him as a sleazeball who gets in his own way, and he presents him as a loser, but he does not present him as a dummy.
No, he may be a creep and a weirdo, but he's not a dummy. He's not stupid.
Don't get me wrong. I think that Eric Roberts is amazing in his role as Paul Snyder, so I personally wouldn't want this movie any other way. But why did Fosse focus on Paul Snyder instead of Dorothy Stratton? We sat down and tried to answer this question.
In Fosse's one of his interviews, he was saying, part of the reason I wanted to tell the story is I've known guys like Snyder my whole life. I've known these small-time con artists. I've known these hustlers.
Stumped them out.
These hustlers. No, he knows them. I grew up around them. I can tell the story because I know these hustlers. My indictment of Fosse has nothing to do with the reality of this fact versus that fact.
Mm-hmm.
It has to do with his complete lack of curiosity when it comes to Stratton.
Well, right. I think also that we touched on this. There was more probably on Fosse at this time than there was on Stratton.
Mm-hmm.
Like with the archival footage that's been that we now have and the information that we now have about Dorothy Stratton. I don't know if you could make a movie about Dorothy Stratton that was faithful to Dorothy Stratton right at when
I made that case already because
I said you
literally need Hefner and Bogdanovich not to have power on the situation to actually make them genuine characters in the story.
But also not only that, at the time this is made, you also don't want to make any kind of negative statement about Dorothy Stratton, who has just been murdered. If you're going to say anything about anyone and maybe fabricate things, you're going to want to fabricate them about the killer.
Yeah, well, also it's just a simple dramatic fact that the character of Paul Snyder, of the penetrator aggressor, is the villain, the foil. And that arc is more interesting.
Well, in a movie full of phantoms, all right, and barely drawn facsimiles of people, they're the only two characters possible. And naturally, the dramatic weight shifts towards Snyder.
Of course, killers are always
it's
more,
the larger character.
Yeah, and killers are always more interesting than their victims.
But again, see, in a story of Dorothy Stratton, you can't have a cipher character of just a random director stand in for Peter Bogdanovich. But in the Paul Snyder story, it doesn't fucking matter who plays that director.
Yeah.
So you don't think
because it's just about her leaving his fold to a successful person. Whether it's Peter Bogdanovich or not makes no difference in the Paul Snyder story. In the Dorothy Stratton story, it makes all the difference in the world.
So you don't buy that Fosse is in any way protecting Dorothy Stratton by turning her into this simple innocent?
No, he's I think he's reducing her.
Okay.
You know, and especially with the evidence available. I mean, obviously Fosse saw They All Laughed. Does he have any opinion of if she would be a good actress? If he does, I had never heard it. I get no sense that he saw that there was anything of any kind of potential as an actress. When I watched They All Laughed, I did. Does Fosse?
I think most people did.
I would assume no. Yeah. I would assume not. I would assume he thinks of her as a centerfold and nothing more.
As vacant.
Yes.
To be honest, because that's kind of what she is portrayed as.
I think he associates her. I think he thinks of her as a very pretty disposable celebrity.
She's clay.
Yes. Yeah, she's clay. She's clay for any man to mold into what they want.
She's a disposable celebrity with an expiration date.
Which I don't think is what Dorothy Stratton was in real life.
Not only do I not think that that was what she was in real life, especially by, and as Sheila Benson described, especially by the evidence given in They All Laughed, where she's not treated as a sex object, she's treated as a love object. And in a cast full of vivacious women, she stands out amongst these wonderful cast of vivacious women. So I'm going right now to an issue of one of my favorite film magazines of the 80s, even though I think it only lasted about 5 issues. All right. It was a magazine called The Movies. And this is from the November 1983 issue that has Mara Hemingway from Star 80 on the cover. And the feminist critic Judith Rossner, she makes a statement. I'm going to ask it as a question. Bob Fosse made a better movie than he would have made if he hadn't allowed himself to identify with Paul Snyder. So I'm asking, did Bob Fosse make a better movie out of Star 80 by allowing himself to identify with Paul Snyder?
And I'm going to say yes. I'm going to say yes, because what may be a disservice in real life to
Dorothy Stratton
is a great service to his movie. And he attached himself to what he understood and the subtext he wanted to inject into the film, and almost turned Dorothy Stratton, even though she's one of the only three people who's real by name, into, like you say, a cardboard character that's no more real than any of the mother, for example.
Than the centerfold. All right. Now, she continues after she makes that statement. I suspect it would have been even more interesting if he had allowed himself to know what it was like to be Dorothy Stratton. And the fact that he didn't even try, he didn't even entertain that idea, is what I think is remarkable. Now, she also goes on to write, if Roberts gives the only extraordinary performance in the film, it is doubtlessly because his talent is greater than Hemingway's. But it is also important to remember that however slick and repellent Snyder is, he is granted the luxury of being a complex human being, while Mario's role is of a sweet young thing with tits.
Right. And maybe the point of the movie is that it's not a biopic.
Well, it is, but it's a biopic of Paul Snyder.
Well, it's half a biopic of Paul Snyder by its own admission. It's half of everything. In fact, Sven Nykvist is even sometimes only lighting half of a face.
Yeah.
As if, well, who knows if it's true or not? He only deserves half my light.
And that's our show. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Video Archives After Show. Have a burning question that you want the answers to? Make sure to write in for a chance to have your question feature on an upcoming episode. Next week, join Quentin and Roger as they discuss 3 new films. Want to know ahead of time what we're watching? Here's a riddle for all of you loyal fans out there. Try and figure it out. The first movie features an actress from Star 80. The second film features my favorite Bond henchman. And the third is a film that was mentioned on a previous after show and features a female character named Jeff. Thanks for spending the last 30 minutes with me. I'm your girl, Gala Avery, signing out for today. See you next time on the Video Archives After Show.